Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arrest of Donald Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, who is charged with assaulting a journalist at a campaign rally in Florida on March 8. Adele Stan, a columnist for The American Prospect, joins us to discuss the new evidence of the contested alleged assault of the former Breitbart reporter Michelle Fields, released today by the police in Jupiter, Florida, that shows Lewandowski yanking Fields away from Trump, who is stone-faced and ignoring her as she walks alongside him trying to interview the Republican frontrunner for President of the United States. Then we'll examine the president's keynote address at the Robin Toner Prize Ceremony honoring outstanding political journalism, where Obama called out the media for its uncritical and excessively generous coverage of Donald Trump. Media critic Robert McChesney, whose latest book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy, joins us to discuss the unusual praise coming from a politician for good investigative journalism, which Obama said matters more than ever, and by the way, lasts longer than some slapdash tweet that slides off our screens in the blink of an eye. Then finally, we'll look into the North Carolina legislature's and governor's obsession with bathrooms, where apparently there is a need for privacy and security against the possibility that one could enter a public toilet straight and come out gay. Molly Worthen, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism, joins us to discuss North Carolina's new anti-LGBT law that the state's attorney general calls a national embarrassment. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently a columnist for The American Prospect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And this new evidence that the Jupiter, Florida police have released, basically what's happened prior to this is the Trump campaign and Lewandowski have denied that they did anything wrong with this journalist from Breitbart, who, by the way, the Breitbart news organization did not defend, and she actually resigned in disgust, I believe, along with the PR person for Breitbart. Breitbart's, you know, pretty much in the bag for Trump, and behaved disgracefully in not defending their own journalist. But now that the evidence seems to make it clear that she was yanked away from Trump, who she was trying to talk to, walking along beside him. But now that the evidence is out, rather than deny it, which is that it even happened in the first place, now the Trump people are going after Michelle Fields. And so what do you make of it?
Well, they have gone after her from the very first moment she made the allegation, which, you know, was backed up by a Washington Post journalist who was standing nearby. They went after her, calling her, you know, trying to say that she had pulled, you know, the same storyline when she was tousled about by police at the Occupy, when she was covering Occupy. They tried to kind of paint her as an unreliable, hysterical woman, you know, and you know, given the Trump campaign's love for women, it suited their narrative, Ian. And then I think that's where they're, you know, they know that their followers are not turned on by anything but that narrative, and whether or not it, you know, comports with reality is irrelevant.
And the Washington Post reporter, Ben Terris, was right behind her and he saw what happened and asked her, are you okay? And she says, Michelle Fields, that was insane. You should have felt how hard he grabbed me. That's insane. I've never had anyone do that to me from a campaign. And I guess that's the point. You know, you've got secret. By the way, the Secret Service didn't think that she was assaulting or bothering the candidate, which is
right.
What the Trump people are now saying. They were right beside him. She was just doing her job. She just had a phone to record audio and a pad and a pencil to take down notes. She was doing her job. So The thing that I find disgusting is that the Breitbart people, who are a right-wing organization, clearly don't give a damn about their own reporters. Maybe that's the way.
Well, at least they're women reporters, or at least anybody who would sully in any way the reputation of one Donald J. Trump. I mean, they are so, as you say, they're totally in the tank for Trump, and what happened to Michelle Fields? I mean, and what was so astonishing about this thing, Ian, is that immediately afterward, Lewandowski told a reporter, it was reported in Lloyd Grove's column, I'm not sure if Grove himself was the original person who originally got the quote, but Lewandowski told a reporter that he had done it because he didn't realize that Michelle Fields was with Breitbart. In other words, he thought she was just a member of the mainstream media, of course, who have been demonized by the Trump campaign.
But at the time, he called her delusional. And now, of course, they are no longer denying it happened. They're just blaming it all on her.
Right.
So what's your sense then of whether it seems like Trump is doubling down, though?
I mean, he is doubling down, and I think that, and I think that suits him. I think it suits his campaign. I don't know that this, in mainstream media and in other circles that are more polite than those of the Donald Trump world, this looks like it would be a terrible besmirching, of a presidential campaign. But if you look at the animus and resentment on which the Trump campaign is built, I don't really see how it is. It's going to look like something to these guys. It's going to look like something that is, at best, even though Trump is denying it ever happened. At best, even if Lewandowski is determined to have done this, her response will be, the response to her will be that, it was just really overblown, that this was no big deal. And, really, compared to what has happened to other people at Trump rallies, it looks like a minor incident by comparison.
He wasn't
punched in the face,
Right, and that unfortunate export from the United Kingdom, Piers Morgan has come out and saying that Michelle Fields should toughen up. There's a history, though, of Lewandowski before Trump hired him, and he comes out of the Koch brothers' stable,
he
was their liaison to the Tea Party, and you've covered the Tea Party extensively since its beginning. Did you come across him?
I did not. I don't recall having done so, but he was the chapter. He ran the New Hampshire chapter of the Koch brothers' field operation known as Americans for Prosperity. And they're quite influential in New Hampshire. He seemed to be useful to them, to the Wisconsin chapter, which was, kind of the where Americans for Prosperity really got its legs. There's a lot of buzz that by the time he left to go to the Trump campaign, really, they were ready to be rid of him because of, all kinds of allegations and of untoward behavior by Lewandowski, particularly toward women. Women reporters complained that he would, they would get calls at 2 a.m. from him, and he didn't seem quite sober, and that there were other, allegations of just bad behavior by him. So the thought is that they were kind of ready to be rid of him when he went to into the Trump camp. And it's interesting because there's no love lost between the Kochs and Donald Trump. They might appear to be playing on the same team to progressivize because they're both captains of private industry, private capital, and you know, they want to, of course, enrich that class. But you know, Trump plays a very different game from that of the Koch brothers.
Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics, and she's currently a columnist for The American Prospect. So he's Lowen Daske's charged with battery, and I'm sure, as we mentioned, Donald Trump is doubling down, and Ann Coulter is joining him, and so is that dreadful Piers Morgan.
And probably Phyllis Schlafly, who also endorsed Donald Trump.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So they're all beating up on this woman whose only crime was she worked for a right-wing news outlet.
I know. It's
What a bizarre political year it is. One of the things I find extraordinary, though, is that even the president's been coming out with the less-than-veiled critiques of, and we're going to be talking about it in a bit with Bob McChesney, with critiques of Trump. And I would have thought that progressives would want this guy elected. If the Republicans are in such a panic.
He'd be nominated, right?
I mean, yeah, nominated, yeah. I mean, if the Republicans are in such a panic that he's going to get the nomination.
Right.
Surely that should tell progressives that for them, those who want a Democrat elected, this would be the best thing that happened to them.
Well, you know, yes and no, I think. In the short term, if you're talking about winning an election, it does appear that Trump does not fare well in a general election, at least given polling matchups at this point in the race. But, you know, polls at this point in the race are always a little, you know, dicey because stuff happens. You never know what's going to be exposed about whom or, you know, people have health issues, whatever. In terms of what's going on in the Republican Party, Ian, I don't think the concern there is simply that they will lose the White House. Because I think that anybody looking at what's going on right now in the Republican Party is, you know, is if not resigned to them losing whomever is their nominee, there's a good shot at that happening. What they're concerned about is losing control of the levers of the party itself. Because if Trump wins the nomination, then he becomes the party's standard bearer, and he controls the convention, and he controls resources that go out to other campaigns, right, to lower-level campaigns, and he controls the party platform. And he is beholden to no one in the party. I mean, even the Koch brothers, whose agenda is often in tension with that of the Republican establishment, require the party to remain intact as it exists now, because their whole infrastructure is built around that structure. So I think this is more about retaining the stop Trump, the never Trump. It's about retaining control of the party by the elites who control it now.
Well, of course, the Republican establishment is pretty hard to define nowadays.
Right.
Who is it? I mean, George W. Bush is not exactly, a powerful political force in the country anymore. His brother just tanked. But the person who's emerging, I think, as the real power broker is Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, who I'm sure is getting an earful from his members, both in the House and the Senate, who are basically saying Trump is going to be such a disaster on the down ballot
right. That
we're all going to wipe out and we lose the Senate and perhaps even lose the House. And that's I've been trying to do some coverage on it lately, and I know you're writing about it too. But that seems to me the most likely scenario, that they'll try and engineer some way to stop Trump from getting the nomination, and Trump might well go off in a huff and do a third party run, which if that happens, of course, that would split the vote three ways, and there wouldn't be a majority in the Electoral College. And guess what? Then it would go to a vote in the House, the very House that Paul Ryan controls. So I don't think that's such a fanciful scenario.
Well, I don't either. I mean, it's getting to the point where, I mean, ballot access will become a problem for that. I mean, different states have different rules and different deadlines for getting on the ballot. And I frankly don't know the deadlines for the big states, which, you know, would matter.
You're talking about whether Trump could launch a viable third-party challenge.
Right. But he could launch one even in a half-baked way that was dangerous enough to mess up the Republican Party in a big way. You know, for instance, you know, if he won Florida, I mean, that's a whole lot of electoral votes. You know, that would really mess them up. So, I mean, I think that he'd be probably content to troll the Republican Party if they deprived him, you know, in that way. He is a vindictive person to just screw them up. But, you know, so whether or not he'd really split the vote three ways, I'm not entirely, you know, how much he would draw from a Democratic candidate, I'm not entirely sure. But he could definitely mess with them. But let's go back to Ryan. The other people from whom I imagine Ryan is getting an earful are the Koch brothers, if not directly, at least through their emissaries. And I think, and if you saw the other day, Scott Walker, another of the Koch brothers' youthful wards, endorsed Ted Cruz. Now, how would that feed into this whole scenario? Well, you know, you see a lot of people who you would not think of Cruz's friends endorsing him now, such establishment figures as Jeb Bush and Lindsey Graham, who are not necessarily allied with the Koch brothers in the same way that Scott Walker is. But nonetheless, the point is that they don't want Ted Cruz to be the nominee. They want to take the nomination away from Donald Trump. So if Trump, you know, doesn't get that 1,237 delegates going into the convention after the first ballot, you know, the convention is cracked wide open, and it doesn't have to, the nominee does not have to be anybody who has won primaries. And that's where the room is made for a Paul Ryan to go waltzing in to save the day.
Well, I guess they all should be thankful that the Secret Service has denied them all showing up with assault rifles, but the people who are likely to show up with assault rifles are Donald Trump's supporters, and presumably they'll be outside.
Well, and that's the thing. They'll be outside in an open carry state. That, you know, that concerns me, and I don't mean to be flippant. I'm not being flippant. That really does concern me. I don't know if there is a way to, you know, create how big a gun-free zone they can create in the whole city of Cleveland in an open carry state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody's talking about, well, there could be fisticuffs in the convention hall. Sure, but there could also be fisticuffs and worse in the streets, and you're also going to have a lot of protesters. I mean, I do think Cleveland is either going to be entirely in lockdown in some way, or it's going to be just utter chaos.
Well, Corey Lewandowski, who has just been charged with battery, Donald Trump's campaign manager, he sort of came to prominence in New Hampshire for organizing a Tea Party rally at which everybody showed up with assault rifles.
Well, they like to do that in New Hampshire. You know, in 1995, I covered an event at the, I think it was the Merrimack Fish and Game Society or something, but really it was just, you know, gun nuts. And they were quick to inform the media that they were all packing. That was one the speaker, and it was like, you know, I think it was a Pat Buchanan event. You know, that's kind of how it goes in the right-wing pockets of New Hampshire. So assault rifles is probably a little more extreme than what I saw. But, you know, yeah, Lewandowski definitely, you know, that's his game. It's violence and misogyny. Oh, what's Trump's game? Oh, violence and misogyny. So there you go.
Well, Adele Stan, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's hope that cooler heads prevail here. But I do think that it's worth paying attention to this coy dark horse, Paul Ryan, who seems to be repeating the same game he played when he was resisting the courtship to become the speaker.
Yes, he likes to be coy, doesn't he?
So, again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a columnist for The American Prospect. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into President Obama's critique of the press. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert McChesney, who's the endowed professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics and hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. His latest book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media Politics and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
A pleasure to be here, Ian.
And President Obama spoke, gave the keynote address at the Robin Turner Prize ceremony, which honors outstanding political journalism based on a New York Times reporter, in honor of a New York Times reporter, Robin Turner. But he took the opportunity to really criticize the press, particularly for their excessively generous coverage of Donald Trump and their largely uncritical coverage of him. And it would seem to me that as Trump, and he certainly has become now the front runner, but as he becomes more and more the big dog in this race and could end up with a nomination, it seems that the tendency is that he gets more credibility as he gets more votes. And people can sort of forget all the terrible things that he said. Is that something that could be? I know the Huffington Post have a little disclaimer at the end of all articles about Donald Trump, pointing out that he's a misogynist, a racist, and wants to ban all 1.6 billion Muslims from the United States.
Well, yes, I think it is a very legitimate concern, because that's generally how it works in the United States for politicians, that if you're successful, you win elections, you don't get scrutinized that closely for things you say. You see when people win an election that the voters have considered them and you sort of get a pass. And then what happens is our news media basically expects competing politicians to raise the issues. They won't raise the issues. So Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders might raise these issues in a general election campaign with Trump. But then so the reporters will report it as a he said, she said, or he said, he said. And that gets them off the hook of actually having to say whether something's true or not.
So when the president, to an audience of journalists, expresses dismay at, and he never mentioned Trump by name, but at the vulgar rhetoric coming out of this campaign targeting women and minorities, and he went on to say, a job well done is about more than just handing someone a microphone, to challenging reporters to probe and to question and to dig deeper. How do you think they feel about that kind of criticism? And as I say, it's unusual for a politician in Obama's case to be actually praise the press and want more, better journalism, more investigative journalism. And he highlighted the Academy Award for the movie Spotlight, which is about an investigative journalism team. So that was pretty unusual. But how do you think they responded?
I would imagine they probably responded quite favorably. I think most journalists would regard themselves as people who would be more critical and challenge Trump. I think also they would characterize the Trump love fest in the news media, overwhelmingly to the commercial television networks, which play such an outsized role, but, you know, that have covered him gleefully, put microphones around him and let him speak however he wanted for whatever length of time he wanted, for what seemed like largely commercial reasons. And I think that print journalists or reporters who aren't connected with those networks, or even some who are, probably would have agreed with Obama. You know, like Nick Kristof wrote a piece in the New York Times the other day basically saying the exact same thing President Obama said.
Well, apparently, somebody did a calculation recently suggesting that Trump has gotten $400 million worth of free media. That's extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, the way he's been covered has been amazing, and I think it owes overwhelmingly to the commercial basis of the commercial news networks, the profit-seeking basis, and that the sort of the culture there is if you get a big audience, good. And so if you have a political story when you're supposed to be covering politics and you generate a larger audience, you know, you're going to keep covering Donald Trump. Donald Trump says something, it's going to be news, no matter what it is, because it will draw an audience. And I think this is where the sort of commercial corruption of journalism shows its ugly face.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert McChesney, who's the endowed professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. And his latest book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. And he will be appearing along with John Nichols at the Peace Center on Sepulveda Boulevard on April the 11th at 7 p.m., which is a KPFK-sponsored event. So one of the president's remarks, though, which seemed to have been directed at Trump, but also a lot of people think it was also a not-so-veiled dig at Bernie Sanders. Obama said that voters would be better served if billions of dollars in free media came with serious accountability, especially when politicians issue unworkable plans or make promises they can't keep. What do you make of that, Bob?
Well, it's hard to respond to a criticism that is so well veiled that it can be unpacked in any number of ways, and not knowing what the president's actual intent was. If it was intended as a critique of Bernie Sanders, I think the president should rest comfortably knowing the news media have done him no favors. So he need not worry that Bernie Sanders has been getting the Trump free ride or the $400 million of free publicity. Poor Bernie Sanders has just won five consecutive blowout victories with 70% or more of the vote. Yet the main discussion in the commercial and corporate news media and NPR is, you know, how much longer can this heat possibly last, since Hillary is the putative and undeniable winner of the Democratic nomination. So I don't think the news media critique holds to Bernie Sanders whatsoever. And if President Obama wants to make a separate critique of Bernie Sanders concerning his policies, then he picked an odd way to do it.
So what explains that, though, Bob? Is it that the mainstream press just are comfortable with safe assumptions? I mean, they can't all be in the bag for Hillary.
Well, I would say that the mainstream press, and by this I mean NPR, PBS, and New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, the main commercial news channels, I think they're, you know, to use a hackneyed term, they really are part of the establishment. And they're peopled by journalists, executives, pundits, a relatively small circle of people who are comfortable in each other's world. And it's a very tight-knit world. And in that world, someone like Hillary Clinton is a major, serious player who's widely respected and taken seriously. And in that world, someone like Bernie Trump is an outsider who doesn't play by the same rules. He's not trying to get rich like everyone else. He seems to have a different type of career. He's not hanging out in the same clubs and restaurants. He doesn't have multiple houses. He's just an oddball in their world and therefore not a serious person in the Upper West Side, inside the Beltway or Upper East Side view of the world. And I think there's a lot of that to this. I mean, Bernie Sanders is simply dismissed out of hand at the beginning, and he's never been undismissed. I mean, despite the successes he has, the still overarching framing mechanism is that Hillary's the natural, logical candidate, and Bernie's just sort of a pain in the butt till he finally realizes he's not going to win, and he gives up.
Well, you know, if love and passion and integrity respect and authenticity and honesty were the metrics, Bernie would have won the presidency by now, because who else is attracting the young, the idealistic? To some extent, Trump is also tapping into the discontent, but he doesn't offer formulas apart from the fact that, join my magical mystery tour and you'll all become millionaires.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think something that you see among Sanders supporters, especially those who critique media coverage, is you say, imagine if the roles were reversed and you had the exact same set of facts for Hillary Clinton, would it be covered differently? For example, if Hillary Clinton was drawing massive crowds all over the country while Bernie was basically doing small controlled events with a couple hundred people at each one and fundraisers, basically secret fundraisers, would the news media be extolling Hillary Clinton's unbelievable popularity and prowess to draw these extraordinary crowds, oftentimes with less than 24 hours notice? He's drawing crowds of 8, 10, 15,000 people. That would be the biggest news story. If Hillary Clinton were drawing the supported young people that is like Bernie is now, that is basically unprecedented in American history, that would be the biggest news story. They'd be running features. And look at Hillary Clinton, how popular she is with the youth, what an extraordinary figure is. But for Bernie Sanders, this barely gets mentioned. That he draws 15,000 to an event is just ho-hum. And Hillary's closed event with 200 people, or mostly people who are looking for jobs in her administration or there because they're required to be there, that gets treated as like the equal of what Bernie's doing, when there's nothing equal about it whatsoever, and wouldn't be regarded that way if roles were reversed.
So you're in Wisconsin, which is a key state coming up a week from today, where it's obviously an important vote for Bernie Sanders and also for Ted Cruz. What's the mood there? What's your sense? I'm not asking you to be a political pundit, but on the other hand, I am.
Well, I don't really mind, because actually I've been canvassing the last 4 days a lot, actively all day, most days, and I've been talking to a lot of people on the ground. This is, you're right, a very important state for Sanders on the Democratic side. And I think what really tells you, traditionally Wisconsin has been a bellwether state for Democrats. I mean, almost every election year there's a contested race, including 2008, 2004, 2000, 1992. I mean, really going right back into John F. Kennedy in 1960, the Wisconsin primary comes at the certain point where you're usually down to just two people or maybe three. And Wisconsin's the bellwether state. You can win Wisconsin's primary, that oftentimes puts you on the path to the White House. That's a sign you're a serious national candidate. Wisconsin has that sort of demographics and political history that for a Democrat, it's a state you've got to prove you can win, because you have to win Wisconsin. It's impossible to win the White House without Wisconsin. And as Wisconsin goes, lots of other states trend, Minnesota, Iowa, the whole region. So it's striking in the last 2 days. We're now hearing Hillary Clinton's surrogates saying, well, Wisconsin's not that big of a deal anymore. That's sort of one of these states that Bernie does well in. We shouldn't expect much from Wisconsin. They're really trying to downplay expectations. I don't think that means they're giving up. I don't think that means think they're going to lose necessarily. But they're clearly trying to prepare their friends at MSNBC and CNN to have a new narrative. So in case she does lose, and possibly lose big, New Hampshire style, they can sort of shift the discussion instantly to something else, so they won't dwell on the fact that it'll be her seventh consecutive major loss.
And what's happening with the comeback of the senator who lost to this horrible Rob Johnson, who's apparently quite vulnerable?
That's right. And Russ Feingold is running to get his seat back.
Right.
And
he lost his seat because the guy, his personal integrity was such that he simply refused to do negative advertising, and the other guy slimed him all over the place and won. So,
the other guy had mountains of money. He's rich himself, and the Koch brothers adore him, so he was going to be able to
outspend Russ no matter what. But really, the real story, and this is the story that doesn't get spoken about enough. In presidential years, Democrats win statewide races as a rule in states like Wisconsin because the voter turnout increases dramatically. And the people who vote in presidential years who don't vote otherwise are young people, poor people. They only vote in presidential years. So Russ lost in 2010, which is an off year, where the voting rate plummets. And the people who don't vote are simply Democrats as a rule. They the Republicans keep voting. And that's why Russ lost in 2010, even though he's a very popular senator. And in 2012, Tammy Baldwin got elected to the U.S. Senate over Tommy Thompson, who had been a very popular governor, a Republican. And it was all turnout related. And I think this is one of the great contributions Bernie Sanders is making to our understanding of electoral politics in America. The first thing you have to look at to understand who wins races is who votes. And we have a very low turnout. And if you look at the primaries this year, for example, the Democratic Party, virtually all of Hillary's victories across the Deep South and into Ohio and North Carolina have been in states where the turnout has been radically lower than it was in 2008. And most of Bernie's victories have been in states where it's been pretty close to 2008, which has been a very high level to begin with, or where they've had dramatic improvement from 2008. So one candidate depends on really not many people voting, and in Bernie's case, the other candidate depends on really increasing the people who get involved in the system.
So, Robert McChesney, just returning to the president's speech at the Robin Turner Awards dinner, and where he made this fairly stinging critique of the press and its uncritical coverage of Donald Trump, and at the same time saying how much journalism matters and how important good journalism is. And but at the same time, his administration, according to a review by the Associated Press, found that the Obama administration had set a record for failing to fulfill freedom of information requests. One in six such requests, which is a total of 129,825, resulted in no documents being provided at all. So,
well, you're right. And in fact, there's been, over the last two or three years, many studies and reports that have come out on really a deplorable freedom of the press record, a secrecy record for the Obama administration. They've been far worse with whistleblowers than even the George W. Bush administration was, which is a pretty low bar. So, no, it is not a good situation. And I think you're getting at a point, Ian, that it is well worth making, because you won't hear it on all those networks I've been talking about, which is that President Obama wants critical coverage of someone like Trump, someone who's sort of outside elite power, like people like him and the Republicans. But he's very comfortable with the type of he said, she said journalism when it comes to people inside in the elites in both parties. He doesn't want people challenging him. He wouldn't like a ruthless fact-checking of the sort of claims he would make. And he doesn't really expect that to be done of Republicans who are sort of, you know, the Mitt Romneys and John McCain's of the world either. What gets him upset is when that same standard is applied to Donald Trump.
Well, Donald Trump, though, you know, here he has a major scandal where his campaign manager, his top guy, was arrested and charged with battery against a right-wing reporter, and they denied that it even had happened. And then new evidence emerged to indicate that something had happened. And what does Donald Trump do? He doubles down, and now that they can no longer deny it, they're beating up on the reporter and saying that she's...
Well, you know, one of the things that's been maddening for President Obama and for just about everyone, including myself, has been that Donald Trump has sort of broken every rule of American mainstream politics. I mean, from the very beginning, he's attacking Megyn Kelly. He's attacking John McCain as not being a hero. I mean, the list is so long, we could do a telethon just going through all the things he said, each of which, by conventional wisdom, would end a political career, or certainly end a campaign. You say anything like that. You look at some of the stuff that got Joe Biden run out of the race once, plagiarizing a Neil Kinnock speech, for example. And, you know, that ended his run. Or Gary Hart having a woman sit in his lap. You know, what Donald Trump blows them out of the water almost on a daily basis. And I think it's been maddening, and this is where President Obama comes in, that, you know, he seems impervious. It's called Reagan a Teflon president. Well, Trump's entire body is in Teflon.
No, it's an extraordinary thing. And as I say, the more popular it gets and the more successful it gets, the less critical the coverage becomes. And people forget the horrible things that he said about just about everybody except rich white men. I thank you for joining us, Robert McChesney.
My great pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert McChesney, the endowed professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics and hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. And his latest book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into privacy and security in North Carolina's bathrooms. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Molly Worthen, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Molly Worthen.
Thanks for having me.
And Molly, I'm trying to get an understanding of North Carolina's legislature and governor's obsession with public toilets and bathrooms in general. The Attorney General of North Carolina said that North Carolina's new law limiting LGBT protections is a national embarrassment. I mean, do they honestly believe that if you walk into a public toilet straight, you come out gay?
Well, of course not. But the question of public bathrooms is highly symbolic and very charged, and it touches on a feature of public life that is familiar to everybody. It allows opponents of gay and LGBT rights to invoke an old and powerful image in the tradition of their resistance to gay liberation, and that is the image of the non-heterosexual predator, right? The adult gay male who will prey on your children. The old conservative argument was that because gay people can't have children of their own, they need to steal ours, they need to convert our children. And so these references to the terror of a transgender man changing, you know, in front of children in the bathroom. This is part of a long tradition of the ways in which opponents of LGBT rights have tried to make this a very vivid culture wars issue for their constituents.
But in terms of a law, in terms of its practical application and implementation, apparently it requires people to use multi-stall bathrooms that match their birth certificates at state agencies, schools, and universities. So what would the actual enforcement of this be like? Every time you go to the bathroom, you have to produce your birth certificate?
Well, right, of course not. And there's been some discussion of this in the coverage of the law that I've read, and it's simply not practical to do, as you say, to require people to carry around their birth certificates for admission to any public bathroom. It's really a symbolic issue, I think. I mean, it's still quite an important one. I mean, the ACLU wouldn't be suing if they thought it didn't matter, but it sends a message to gay and transgender people across the state, and it really is evidence of a long-standing and growing divide in this state between our progressive cities, at least relatively speaking, progressive, and our rural counties. that is one of the culture wars we have here in North Carolina is city versus county. And this law is intended to send a message to the cities of North Carolina that despite, our libertarian Republicans, habit of decrying government that is too big and powerful, they only advocate local control when local means state control. They do not want the cities of North Carolina to go out on their own and try to liberalize social policies like this or raise the minimum wage or do anything else that undermines the power of the state legislature.
Well, it's a bit odd and an obvious contrast to think that the Republican governor of Georgia, Nathan Deal, vetoed a similar law in Georgia. Obviously, there was tremendous heavy backlash from businesses, including Coca-Cola, that were going to boycott the state, which is almost synonymous with Coca-Cola. And also, I believe the same thing happened back sometime back in Indiana. Why, at this point, are Governor Pat McCrory and company not getting that message? Or is there not enough clout with the business community in terms of North Carolina's vulnerability to a boycott?
Well, I think the Republican Party in every state is divided by these same factions. And, just as there were Christian conservatives in Indiana and Georgia who were very angry at the failure of those laws, the same is true here, although it's reversed, that there are more business-friendly, more I suppose you could say pragmatically-minded conservatives who do not believe that this was the right thing to do. And, McCrory has tried to sort of have it both ways. He did not take the lead on this. The legislature called it special session without him, but of course he did sign it into law. He was elected as a business-friendly, moderate Republican who I think pitched himself to voters as someone who would play ball with both sides and take a kind of middle way. But in practice, he has proven to be rather beholden to the hardline conservative Christians in his caucus, and this is another instance of that. We'll have to see how it plays out. It may be that the backlash from the business community is powerful enough to encourage some of the conservative Christians to back away from their stance, but I don't see any evidence of that quite yet.
And again, I'm speaking with Molly Worthen, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism. And the Attorney General, who has taken this stand, is under a lot of heat. The Senate, North Carolina Senate leader Phil Berger, is asking Cooper to resign for failing to defend the law. And of course, I don't know exactly whether the law used the same kind of framework as the Georgia law. The Georgia law was a religious freedom bill. I don't know what was the rubric under which it was passed in North Carolina.
Well, it's called the Public Facilities Privacy and Securities Act. I haven't examined the language of the bill, but I don't think it foregrounds. Well, while religious freedom is an issue, it's always part of the context here. I don't believe it's foregrounded in quite the same way as it was in Georgia and Indiana.
So it's a public bathroom security. Was that one?
Privacy and Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act.
I see. Okay. Well, it's security extending to bathrooms is an interesting concept, but it's sort of almost like homeland security and terrorism rolled into. I mean, I know I have a tendency to be facetious about it, but I don't know how else you can treat this. I mean, it does seem to be based on an absurd kind of paranoia.
Well, I think that's a reasonable critique, but in my line of work, the most fruitful analysis comes from really trying to get into the minds of the people who put this law together and believe that it is just policy. And I come back to that image that I've seen repeated by a couple of the defenders of this law of the male predator, passing himself off as a woman and changing in front of little terrified schoolgirls. That is the image that those who favor this law have in mind. That is what they mean by security. And although that is quite remote from what most of us view as reality. I mean, certainly there aren't any demonstrated instances of that happening in Charlotte or any other community that is favoring, you know, opening all bathrooms to people of all gender representations. That's the propaganda image that is fueling this notion of security that the title of the bill referenced.
So, Molly Worthen, you mentioned earlier that you're more interested in understanding why people believe these things rather than sort of ridiculing their beliefs, and I think that's extremely useful. So what is going on with the evangelical Protestant community in this country? I've often, if you watch, for example, evangelical television, it's quite often hard to not see it as a sort of front for right-wing politics. And it's obviously become a very important part of the Republican Party, in many ways a litmus test in the early primaries, particularly in Iowa, whether or not the politicians pass the evangelical test. But why is Donald Trump getting more votes than Ted Cruz, whose father is a fundamentalist preacher? Here's this thrice-divorced casino owner who's given to expletives. Why is he getting the support? Do you have an answer for that?
Well, I think Trump's success so far among these voters who are telling pollsters that they are evangelical, whatever that word really means to them, it's always hard to know. I think it suggests to us that the culture war issues, as we normally think of them, are not everything, or at least they are embedded in a larger context. I have seen that, you know, a number of interviews with these voters who identify as evangelical and favor Trump, and they have said that he understands their broader anxieties. He speaks to the way in which they feel left behind. They feel that their country is being taken over by people unlike them. And from what I can tell, they don't seem particularly bothered by his lackluster church attendance or his record of divorce. I mean, the divorce issue is rather a silly one, considering that evangelicals' rates of divorce are as high or higher than those of Americans at large. So it would be surprising for them to hold that against him too much. But they see him as generally not someone who will damage the interests of Christians and who will take a stand on what they see as these politically incorrect matters such as immigration and free trade, that those wealthy insiders who in their view have taken over the Republican Party have turned to the advantage of elites and away from that of the common man. And, you know, frankly, the issue of homosexuality and transgender identity is one that reveals, I think, a real generation gap in among evangelical Americans. I think this North Carolina law reflects the real phobia and prejudice that is still quite common among older evangelicals, but it is a sentiment that is really fading away among younger evangelicals that I speak to, who, while many of them might still say that non-heterosexual sex outside marriage is a sin, they have lost what I call the ick factor that their parents' generation feels in regard to people who depart from heterosexual norms. They know more gay and transgender people. These people are their friends. And they're simply not inclined in the way that the moral majority generation is to make this into a battle. It doesn't seem to resonate with them in quite the same way. So, you know, this law causes great consternation and frustration for liberals right now, but I think it's kind of a dying breath. I don't think that the next generation of evangelicals will mount these same battles against gay and transgender people.
So in terms of the millennials, the evangelicals that you talk to, it does seem in general millennials are sort of post-sexual and post-racial. And my understanding is that, I don't know whether there have been polls done, but I've heard this anecdotal information for some time, that they're far more tolerant, the younger generation. As a political force, are they going to hew to the right as their parents do and be Republicans? Or is Bernie Sanders winning any of them over? He's certainly winning over the young vote.
Right. I think it remains to be seen. Certainly, younger evangelicals, millennial evangelicals do poll to the left of their parents, but conservative evangelicals will say, well, you know, that's the classic, you know, youth trend, and they'll find their way back to the conservative side of the spectrum, you know, once they're older and marry and have children. And to some extent, I think there will be some correction. Perhaps not the correction that their, you know, conservative baby boomer parents would hope for. I think that this generation of younger evangelicals is disillusioned with politics. They've grown up in an age of really unprecedented polarization. They're quite cynical. They resent being immediately associated in the public mind with Jerry Falwell and the moral majority and the very aggressive political tactics of an earlier generation. And even those of them who are still quite conservative have a very different, a more irenic approach. I think they are more inclined, maybe, than their parents to come to terms with the fact that conservative Christians are increasingly a moral minority in this country. They are a counterculture. And I see more young evangelicals embracing that. But the popularity of Donald Trump in evangelicals as a whole suggests to me that that narrative of Christianity as a counterculture is not one that resonates with huge swaths of white Protestant Americans, who may or may not go to church, mind you, but who are not quite ready to say we are a minority. This is our country, is really their feeling. And I hear Donald Trump using precisely the language that Jerry Falwell used in 1979, 1980, when he says, I'm going to take our country back. We are the silent majority. That's the language he's using, and he didn't invent that language. You can find it in the 1970s. So this is in some ways a kind of repeat of the way Nixon, aided by, in later years, by the Christian right and, you know, into the election of Ronald Reagan, how that precipitated a kind of realignment of the lower working class white native-born Americans who felt ignored by certain elements of the Republican elite.
Well, just in closing then, of course, Donald Trump is supported by Jerry Falwell Jr., and in his address to Liberty University, Donald Trump referred to 2 Corinthians as though it was like 2 Corinthians went into a bar.
Right.
Nevertheless, it didn't seem to hurt him. What's happening, though, with the Moral Monday demonstrations in North Carolina? Are they still being sustained?
Well, I think there are still ongoing protests, but the media spotlight has certainly moved away from them, and there's not quite the energy right now that there was a year or two ago. We may see that ramp up again as the presidential race heats up, but I think progressives in the state are in a bit of a holding pattern. It remains to be seen whether they will rally to Roy Cooper. It's not clear to me.
Well, Molly Worthen, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Molly Worthen, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.